Hello, and thanks for listening. My name is Jason Middleton, and this is Techonomics. Scott Galloway has written and published a book this week that may well come to not only describe a Silicon Valley zeitgeist, but likely come to define it. The book is titled The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. So let's go in order of the book. First, Amazon.
So many different businesses that typically, if you had laid them out to a business school professor 20 years ago, someone would have said, this just isn't possible. So it's the question isn't what businesses will Amazon be in. The question is what businesses won't they be in?
And now an Apple tease.
Apple, most profitable company in history. This quarter, Apple will do twice the profits that Amazon has done in its entire history as a company.
A snippet from the Facebook discussion.
There are more people who have a meaningful relationship with Facebook right now than Christianity.
And finally, a thought on Google.
Yeah, Google probably has the greatest concentration of IQ in the history of mankind. I think there's more just general smarts at Google than there was at NASA.
On their own, an analysis of each of these companies would be compelling to techies and non-techies alike because we all use them. They touch us in some way. Mr. Galloway opens the book with a positioning workshop for each of these four. He then moves to likely outcomes, things like regulation and pushback. He also teases out lessons that entrepreneurs of all stripes can glean from the rise of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Each of them got to be on his list for very distinct reasons, reasons that are leading to combustive combat in the marketplace among them. Here's my very lightly edited chat with Professor Scott Galloway.
Scott Galloway, Professor of Marketing, NYU Stern.
Mr. Galloway, thank you so much for giving time this morning. We're going to dive into the book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, in just a moment. Recently on this show, we've had Kara Swisher on to talk about the future zeitgeist. We've had Vivek Wadhwa on, who basically asked us if we wanted to choose between Star Trek and Mad Max. We had Kevin Kelly on recently telling us to embrace the future, own our privacy, and start selling it back to these companies. And I have to ask, this book that you have is probably going to be a seminal book, and I'm wondering why this book and why now? Because you seem to be defining a zeitgeist.
So that's just pure luck. I've studied these four companies for the better part of the last decade, and I believe they tap into a specific instinct, and they're even more influential and powerful than we believe. And I also believe as entrepreneurs that we can learn a lot from the business practices of these four companies.
Your expertise is marketing, of course, but you have a lot of business experience beyond being in the ivory tower at NYU Stern, right?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I kind of made my way in San Francisco, started a company out of Berkeley Business School called Profit, a brand strategy firm, and then started a firm called Red Envelope, a multi-channel retail company.
Could you grant me the conceit that we put four legs on the stool? We'll talk a little bit about each company to begin with, and then we'll move into the conclusions. And I can just read you like maybe one sentence that I chose from each of the preview chapters.
Yep.
Okay, cool. On Amazon, it's on page 23. Retail may have never been, on a risk-adjusted basis, a good business, but it was markedly less awful before Seattle's great white shark of retail showed up and began eating everything. Give me a little bit of background on that, because I think that you kind of set up that something that's happening now that was set up really, really early with Jeff Bezos.
Amazon needs one person to transact the same amount of retail that most retailers need two. So if Amazon grows its business $20 billion this year, we're going to lose somewhere between 30 and 50,000 cashiers, merchants, and security guards inside a store. Amazon is now responsible for about 50 or 60% of all online growth and fully a third of all retail growth in the U.S. So if you're talking about growth, which is sort of the mother's milk of any business and drives your stock market valuation, you're really talking about Amazon. And Amazon's become so dominant and has such a great reputation in the marketplace that they can now perform what I would refer to as Jedi mind tricks. And that is they can just look at an industry and begin inflicting pain. From the time Amazon announced the acquisition of Whole Foods to the time it closed the acquisition, pure play grocer, largest pure play grocer in the U.S., Kroger, shed a third of its value because Amazon had purchased a competitor that was 1/11th the size of Kroger's. We've never seen anything like this.
It is an inverse industry, isn't it? Because isn't it normal for a juggernaut within an industry to kind of rise the tide for all the boats?
Yeah, typically that's an interesting point. So Amazon has become retail's antichrist, whereas typically firms trade in sympathy with one another. When the stock of Macy's goes up, the stock of JCPenney, Sears, and you would think Amazon goes up. But now when Amazon goes up, the rest of retail goes down because the market assumes that Amazon's victories come at the expense of other retail. And when Sears announces or Williams-Sonoma announces a bad quarter, Amazon stock goes up because people assume that that means Amazon is continuing to take share away from other retailers.
That is a powerful assumption if it's resonating with investors and market managers and portfolio managers. That's incredible. I want to circle back on what you said about if Amazon points its cannon in any direction. Isn't Amazon largely a logistics company now?
A lot of people think Amazon is a search engine with a warehouse attached to it, but it'd be hard to say Amazon is any specific type of business. Amazon's going to spend $4.5 billion on original TV content this year, second only to Netflix, well ahead of NBC, ABC, and HBO. Amazon is now the fastest growing online, and with its acquisition of Whole Foods, it's now the fastest growing offline retailer. It's the number one share leader in the cloud. It has so many different businesses that typically if you had laid them out to a business school professor 20 years ago, someone would have said, this just isn't possible. So it's the question isn't what businesses will Amazon be in. The question is what businesses won't they be in?
I'm reminded of Exponent, which is a podcast that I listen to. You may listen to it sometimes, too. And it's based on how the internet, it disrupts and moves forward. And listening to your answer right now, I'm feeling like Amazon is kind of the embodiment of the internet. And wherever it snakes through is what it's disrupting and sometimes owning.
Amazon really is. It is online commerce. And to a certain extent, it's become offline commerce as well. I mean, Walmart has added almost $250 billion in top-line revenue. And they've added, in exchange for that, the market has awarded them with an additional $34 billion in market cap, whereas Amazon, in the last 10 years, has added around $120 billion in top-line revenue. But in exchange for that, the market has bid up their stock about $400 billion in revenue. So the marketplace wants to love Amazon, and as a result, Amazon's secret weapon is access to the cheapest capital for longer than any company in modern history. So Amazon can throw more stuff up against the wall or try 10 things, or every old economy company can try one. They're playing unfair. If you ever played Texas Hold'em poker, at some point when one person has more chips than everybody else, they can muscle everybody else out of the game. Amazon is the business that has more chips right now.
It sounds a little bit like the cheap capital that in the 19th century railroads were afforded.
That's an interesting point. Amazon sucks up a lot of attention, a lot of oxygen, Amazon doesn't have nearly the market share in any one business that the railroads or Ma Bell had. If we were going to talk about that, we'd talk about Google. But Amazon seems to be soaking up all the kind of capital, if you will, but not only financial capital, human capital. The number one recruiter of students from my class at Stern 10 years ago was American Express. And the investment banks competed for the number two spot. Now clear and away the number one recruiter, Amazon.
A fascinating point. And I want to close with Amazon. And I'm dwelling on Amazon a little bit because you led your book with it. So I imagine this is important to you. I'm sure all four are important, but I'm going in the order of the book. The last one was a few days, I believe 7 or 8 days before it was announced that Amazon had bought Whole Foods. You predicted it. You may have done it on CNBC. I don't remember where you did it. You may have done it with Kara. I'm not sure.
Both places, actually.
Okay, cool. Did you have research on that? Was that just a shot in the dark?
So there's no getting around it. There was a lot of luck involved there, but it made perfect sense. Amazon is trying to establish a very intense relationship with Prime that now is in 60% of households have Prime in the U.S., but specifically they're focused on wealthy households. And it's difficult to create intensity across any relationship unless you have a lot of fluid contact. And there's no way to be in a consumer household more than once or twice a week unless you offer grocery. And when you look at affluence, when you look at distance or proximity to affluent households, when you look at access to long tail brands in the organic space that are growing, when you look at the value of just 450 warehouses that have been leased and are well lit and staffed by intelligent people, Amazon could shut down Whole Foods stores and just make them warehouses and justify the purchase. I thought this made perfect sense, And I think my exact terms were, I can't imagine why they wouldn't acquire Whole Foods. So I think this made all the sense in the world. I think it's going to be for Amazon what Instagram was for Facebook. I think this is going to be the best acquisition in retail in several decades.
The research that I saw just this week shows that the heat maps around the parking lots around Whole Foods increased by X percent, but it was a significant increase since the purchase by Amazon, too. Does that surprise you at all?
Oh, no. I mean, the only complaint, well, let me ask this. What is the only reason you don't shop more often at Whole Foods until Amazon took it over? What traditionally has been the only reason you wouldn't shop all the time at Whole Foods?
Pricing.
That's exactly right. And Amazon is going to take their 0% return hurdle and their unbelievable operational expertise, and they're going to cut prices dramatically at Whole Foods. Whole Foods is about to become the grocery equivalent of a Mercedes for the price of a Toyota. In one word, Whole Foods is about to become, from a consumer perspective, awesome.
We're speaking with Scott Galloway. He's the author of the new book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. He's also an NYU Stern professor. Professor, I'd like to move to Apple real quick. These are huge stories for these around these companies, but I'm going to kind of drill into just one thing. And it has to do with the messianic Steve Jobs, in a way. It's the combination, according to your math, dickhead plus vision. And I think that everybody here who lives in the Valley, at least, would agree with that. But on page 80, you talk about the brick and mortar, not pivot, but the brick and mortar opportunity that Steve saw by putting somebody on the board and moving in that direction. Where along the line for Apple did that lie, and what did it lead to?
So if you were to say what one decision has created more shareholder value than any other decision in the history of business, the majority of people would probably zero in on Apple's decision to launch a phone. And I would argue that they got the brand right, but the decision wrong. Probably the craziest, most irrational decision that resulted in the largest increase in shareholder value was Steve Jobs and Apple's decision to forward integrate into that crazy channel that was supposedly in decline and totally contrary to everything we thought about the future, and to open 500 stores, or more specifically, temples to the brand. So as a result, its closest competitor, Samsung, can make a better phone, and some people would argue they have already. But going into an AT&T or Verizon store is just not nearly the experience or the brand-enhancing messianic temple-like experience you have when you go into these spectacular places of brand worship called the Apple Store. So this crazy decision to reallocate billions of dollars out of traditional branding into leases in the form of stores, just as stores and retail were supposedly going into decline, was truly a visionary genius move. It has probably created $300 or $400 billion in shareholder value.
If I think about Steve Jobs' idea of a walled garden, by your description, I see the store or the temple being kind of like the gate closing and almost locking, because that's why people don't jump over the wall towards Samsung these days, I think.
That's the correct analogy, because the smartest companies, and these guys are very smart, is they use digital technologies to scale really fast, because you can grow a business really quickly when it's mostly dependent upon zeros and ones. Once they get to a point where they're recognized as the leader and they have access to capital, they then immediately turn around and build analog moats. So just as nine women can't have a baby in a month, Samsung, if they decide that stores is the right strategy, it'll take them 10 years to get anywhere near what Apple has done. So whether it's Facebook laying cable, whether it's Google laying fiber, you know, kind of name the brand, Amazon and their warehouse network, these companies use digital technologies to scale, but now to protect their businesses, they're digging analog moats.
Did their usage of these beautiful temples also give them some headroom when it comes to technological advances? Basically, what I'm saying is, do you think that Apple is a high fashion company that does some tech now?
Apple decided it no longer wanted to be the best house in the worst neighborhood, and that's computer hardware, which is a notoriously low-margin business. Mm. They wanted to be the best house in the best neighborhood, which is luxury. And luxury appeals to a more emotional part of our brain. We buy luxury items to feel closer to God and to feel more attractive to the other sex. And as a result, this sort of irrational thinking, if you will, translates to higher margin. So you don't buy an Apple phone because it's a better product. You buy an Apple phone to signal power, affluence, and that you're part of the innovation class. And as a result, Apple now enjoys margins, or operating margins, that are somewhere between Hermes and Ferrari. So what the company has done is literally the impossible in the world of business, and that is it's a low-cost producer. It builds the most powerful, or excuse me, the most popular phone, meaning they can produce the phone for a lower cost than anyone trying to produce a similar phone because of their power in the supply chain.
Right.
But at the same time, they're the premium price product. The analogy in the auto industry would be if you had an auto brand with the margins of Ferrari and the production volumes of Toyota. As a result, Apple, most profitable company in history. This quarter, Apple will do twice the profits that Amazon has done in its entire history as a company.
Amazing statistics. Professor Galloway, again, I'm trying to march forward because I'm cognizant of your time. Page 99. You mentioned there of the Apple answer, kind of, we want to feel good about ourselves, closer to God and sexier by buying Apple products. Facebook makes us feel good for different types of reasons. On page 99, no other media firm in history has combined Facebook's scale with its ability to target individuals. Let's unpack that one.
Facebook's the most successful thing, or the Facebook feed is arguably the most successful thing in the history of mankind. Facebook Inc. properties have a relationship with 2 billion consumers. That's more successful than communism, capitalism. The only thing I could think of that potentially has a relationship with more people is soccer, but it's not able to monetize it the way that Facebook is. So Facebook, there are more people who have a meaningful relationship with Facebook right now than Christianity. If the phone is the item or the object that defines our age, 80% of our time on a phone is spent in-app, and 6 of the 10 top apps are from Facebook. So is your phone a communications device? No, it's the hardware or the utility for Facebook. So a company with 17,000 people and $450 billion in value, contrast that with an auto company that typically has 250,000 people and a $50 billion market cap. We've just never the most successful thing in the history of mankind.
Facebook is, to me, a feedback loop, and with the like buttons and the other options to show some kind of digital emotion, for lack of a better phrase, I noticed even today the creator of the like button is jumping out and not using it anymore, has limits on his own usage of Facebook, which is why I think maybe it does not have the growth potential of the other 3 that are mentioned in your book. Does my argument hold water in broad strokes?
That's an interesting point. The core Facebook platform isn't growing as fast, but what Facebook has also done that's exceptional is they've probably made the best acquisitions of the last 20 years in tech. Instagram, which Mark Zuckerberg was criticized for being the boy CEO, paying $1 billion for a company with only 19 people, was arguably the best acquisition in technology of the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. This company, by almost any metric, would likely be valued somewhere between 60 and $150 billion, 4 or 5 years post-acquisition. And that continues to grow and drive growth. WhatsApp also continues to grow. So this company has not only been outstanding with its core platform, it's made some bold bets on acquisitions that have paid off. It's also likely the most agile company in the world, going from 0% of their revenues in mobile to about 85% in 3 to 4 years. We all knew mobile was coming, but most of us have not been able to transition our businesses such that $8 and $10 come from mobile. So this is, you know, arguably you could argue right now this is the best managed, most agile company if you were to go back 5 years.
So agility and execution, 2 out of 3, I would say, are getting to a scale where we might want to talk about regulation, which I think we're going to have to circle back on after we talk about Google. And on your page 154, one of my favorite sentences was basically that Google seems to be, and always has been, aligned with the goal of execution. I'm using a marketing word there with alignment, but it seems to be very disciplined in its approach, in its vision statement. It's delivering on the mission statement on a scale that has never been seen.
Yeah, Google probably has the greatest concentration of IQ in the history of mankind. I think there's more just general smarts at Google than there was at NASA or working on the Manhattan Project. And they've been outstanding at assembling just incredibly smart people. In some ways, they're the most vulnerable because it really is, to a certain extent, a one-trick pony. They have one product that does about 110% of their profit of their profits and about 90% of their revenues in that search. And it's a great pony to have. But in terms of traditional regulation that breaks up a company because of concentration of market share, Google's most vulnerable because they control 90%+ market share of search in most markets it deals in. And keep in mind, search is now a business that is bigger by revenue in the entire advertising market of every nation with the exception of the U.S.
That's another amazing statistic. We're speaking with Professor Scott Galloway, author of The Four, The Hidden DA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google. Okay, we talked about Amazon getting to a certain scale and setting the expectations of zero margin is fine, and investors are like, great, cheap capital. That sounds like a utility to me. I was trying to make that point with my 19th century analogy. It may have been oversimplistic, but are these companies on a whole outrunning regulation at this point? And if they are, who's doing best and who's doing worse?
Yeah, it's a correct question. We have companies that I think kind of get the mother of all hall passes and don't endure the same scrutiny as other firms. I think when Microsoft got to not even a half the kind of influence or power that these companies have, regulators began sort of sniffing around the edges. And I think these companies have done a great job of keeping regulators and the government at bay. They've kind of, in my view, they wrap themselves in a very progressive blue or rainbow or pink blanket to create an illusionist trick where people see them as sort of nice and friendly and very benign. Even if sort of 9 to 5 during the business day, they're more reminiscent of the spawn of Darth Vader and Ayn Rand. These are very, very competitive, hard-hitting companies. But they've done a great job of largely staving off regulation. However, I do believe it's coming. But it's going to not come where you expect it from, or not come from where you expect it. I think, like a lot of great conflicts, it's going to break out in Central or on the European continent, because here in the U.S., we register tremendous upside from these companies in terms of growth. They're a tremendous source of pride. They hire a lot of our students. But Europe gets a lot of the downside, the job destruction, the fears around privacy, the anti-competitive behavior, and doesn't register as much of the upside. There aren't that many hospital wings or university buildings named after Google or Facebook millionaires. So you're going to see regulators go after one or more of these companies, but it's going to come out of the EU first.
Right. And those fines, I see as them, as a collective market, trying to pump the brakes on the innovation that has happened here because of the lack of regulation. I mean, because doing business in the EU is rather stratified.
It's a complicated and nuanced issue, but at the end of the day, the European Commission and these fines have somewhat been a nuisance and not been, Facebook was fined $116 million for what the EU Commissioner on Competitiveness said was effectively lying to them about their ability to share data in between the Facebook core platform and the WhatsApp platform in order to get the acquisition approved by the equivalent of the FTC or the Antitrust Commission in Europe. So they fined them $116 million, which on a $19 billion acquisition is sort of basically like a 0.66% fine. So what regulators have said to date to these companies implicitly is, your best strategy from a shareholder standpoint is to lie to us. What they've done is they've issued the equivalent of a 25-cent parking ticket when you refuse to pay the $100 an hour meter. The right strategy has been to break the law. And I think that's going to change. I think you're going to see the first $10 billion plus fine against one or more of these companies come out of the EU in the next 12 months.
You mentioned something right there that I kind of want to circle on, too, which is the quote unquote the user, right? That's the term we use in the Valley or in journalism. These are people that are getting in. And if you are not paying for your product, then you are the product. I know that's an old axe, but it seems to be holding pretty true. And you say that worm might be turning. What do you think about on the user end? What's going to happen for us? I mean, or how are we going to better gird our loins?
So I don't think consumers, a lot of people say, well, consumers are going to start unfriending Facebook or not using Amazon. I think these companies add such tremendous utility and joy to the consumers' lives. The war against tech isn't probably going to come, big tech isn't going to come from the consumer. It's going to likely come from regulators as people get angrier and angrier and sort of begin supporting or nudging or voting for elected officials that begin to take a more populist stand against these companies. So the real war, after it breaks out in Europe, would probably be a state's district attorney that decides to go after one of these companies as he or she sees an opportunity to become the governor off of a very populist argument that starts saying, look, these companies are not good for us and need to endure the same scrutiny as other companies. And you're beginning to hear more and more of that populist rhetoric come out of Washington.
My last question for you, Professor, is why not Netflix? Why wasn't Netflix in the book?
So a lot of people say, well, who was fifth and why didn't you include the fifth? The company I probably should have included, if we called the company the five, would have been Microsoft, who has performed incredibly well. Stocks at an all-time high, has, I believe, the third largest market capitalization in the world right now. But the honest answer is I don't understand that company as well, nor find it as interesting. But they would, you would argue they should, they kind of earn their right to be a part of this group. Netflix could arguably also be one of the five, because at the end of the day, each of these companies is an operating system for information or for media or for retail. And Netflix has become an operating system for joy, if you will. And that is, it's become the home screen or the operating system for the second most powerful or important screen in our lives. And that's the television. A lot of people, especially millennials, when you walk into their home, their TV screen is their Netflix home screen. Millennials are spending more time on Netflix than the rest of cable television combined. If you have your child just watch Netflix, which is ad-free, they save 11 days in ads. So this is a company that, if it continues its march, could punch a, you know, could punch in the same weight class. The mother of all celebrity death matches, though, may be shaping up, and that will be Amazon versus Netflix, as Amazon spends more and more money on original content. It's going to be very interesting.
You're right. That is. And the reason I mentioned Netflix specifically was because of the $1 increase this week that they announced. And I went on the air and said, hey, I think investors should be happy about this. It will only increase margins. At the very least, it'll eat into the production budget that they've built into the billions moving into next year.
I think they could double the price. I mean, the weird thing about these companies is they seem to have adopted Amazon's gestalt of replacing profits with vision and growth. But I think there's a lot of headroom around almost all of these companies in their pricing. The only one that has really taken advantage of their pricing power is Apple, who continues to price at the premium end. And the result is their stock doesn't get the same multiple, but they are the most profitable company in the world.
And to mention Microsoft one last time, the reason I'm with you on that one, too, is because I think a lot of their work is being done below the waterline on the artificial intelligence tip. And I think that Google and Microsoft, that might be another celebrity deathmatch that only nerds like me and you would get into. But I think that the AI tip is where a lot of battling is happening already.
Yeah, but the number one spender in terms of R&D is now Amazon, again, taking advantage of that cheap capital. So they're all starting to infringe on each other's turf, whether it's Microsoft competing against Amazon in the cloud, but Amazon has triple the market share in computer hardware. Amazon butts up against Apple, but the most innovative product of 2015 and 16 wasn't the Apple Watch or the Apple Pods. It was Amazon's Echo. Amazon competes against Facebook and Google for digital marketing dollars from advertisers. But even in that realm, while Amazon doesn't control nearly the share, Amazon Media Group is now growing faster than Facebook or Google. So if you were to say if there's one firm pulling away from the others, it'd be hard to argue it's not Amazon. This is a company firing on all 12,000 cylinders right now.
All right, I'm almost out of time, and this may not be for air, but do you have any takeaways from the Google hardware launch of this week? I've been testing the Mini. I kind of like it. I already had a Home at home anyway.
The battleground over the last 10 years has been the phone. The new battleground for all of big tech is in the home. There really isn't one operating system in the home controlling you. The weapon of the software is going to be voice, and we're seeing Siri go up against Alexa, which is also now competing against Google Home. But all of these companies have aimed their howitzers at the house and are making huge investments in hardware and technology to try and become your trusted shepherd and live in technology, if you will. Next big battleground is the home.
Then hopefully we can have you back on. We can talk about that again.
I'd enjoy that. Thanks for having me.
Professor Galloway, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time. Have a great weekend. I know you're on a book tour, but you're prolific. Otherwise, it's amazing. And I really do hope we can talk again.
I appreciate you saying that. Thanks very much for having me.
That was marketing professor and author Scott Galloway. His new book, The Four, The Hidden DNA of Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google, is literally a must-read if you're into business or marketing, retailing. How about anything any of these companies touch? My name is Jason Middleton, and this has been Techonomics. Thanks again for listening.